The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Wednesday, the 1st of April, 2020. On the podcast today, Gobind Sawhney, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, Danny Swick, Chief Operating Officer, and Austin King, Head of Investor Relations for Bloke Ack Alpha Growth Fund. And they're all from, of course, Alpha Growth, ALGW ticker, and they all provide an update on business. Plus, I also have Keith Coughlan, Managing Director of European Metals Holdings. That's EMH ticker. And Keith explains their lithium project in the Czech Republic and outlines future milestones. Also on the podcast, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talks about commodities and mentions the following companies: Gem Diamonds, Vast Resources, and Scott Gold Resources. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. You can see both these lists, top 10 versions of these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Gobind Sawhney, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, Danny Swick, Chief Operating Officer, and Austin King, Head of Investor Relations for the Black Oak Alpha Growth Fund. And they're all part of course, Alpha Growth, and ALGW. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Yep. Thank you, Justin. And, you know, I don't want to distract from the current situation of COVID-19, and our hearts and minds go out to everybody that's impacted with this. However, we do feel we owe our shareholders this update, given that it's the end of Q1 of 2020. Let's proceed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's affecting everyone. But like I said, the best thing we can do is try and, you know, carry on as best we can. And it's a changing landscape, as always. So, Gobind, for people not familiar with Alpha Growth, first of all, can you sort of recap the business and business model, please?
Yeah, no, happy to. So, you know, the company's business is to provide advisory and consultancy services to, you know, the existing and prospective holders of life settlement assets or longevity assets. This includes giving advice on the acquisition and disposals of those assets, performance monitoring, analytical service in relation to those assets. And very simply, we generate our revenue through fees. And these can be earned by a combination on transactional and building what AUM or assets under management. And those are the strategies that we have developed and continue to work on.
Excellent stuff. And what is the current state of operations here?
Yeah, very, very simply. I mean, these are U.S.-based assets. Mm-hmm. Our main office, where myself, Danny and Austin and Rajiv are located, is located in a professional office park complex in Newport Beach, California. We maintain a lean operation and have administrative and office supports functions that are part of our office complex, you know, again, maintaining a lean overhead. We acquired COVA a year ago to incorporate our actuarial expertise into our business. It's been very useful in our various strategies. And even though I think some of our shareholders have mentioned that they've noticed that we've modified some of the acquisition terms, which was to accommodate some personal requirements for Rajiv, we still retain all the attributes of providing this internal actuarial analysis, and we'll be adding skill sets as needed when needed. But our mindset is to keep our overhead as low as possible, bring in professionals as needed, and keeping a lean operation, but yet providing high quality, best of breed asset management in the longevity asset sector.
Excellent. And so, life settlement market, is it growing at the moment? And how is the asset class viewed?
Yeah, the market continuing to grow. I would say a lot of that has to do with the marketing and advertising that's going on here in the U.S. There's a lot of radio ads, television commercials, and digital marketing that's notifying the consumers that if they have a life insurance policy and they no longer need it or want it, they have the option to sell it. And according to the Conning Research 2019 Life Settlement Report, they think that just as an estimate of $100,000 minimum face value policies, that over the next 10 years, there's an average of about $188 billion to $230 billion in face that will be available in the secondary market. Of that, about over the next 10 years, they estimate that each year there will probably be about $6.4 billion in face settled in the secondary market.
Excellent stuff. Okay, so could you go through the stated aspirations and where are they now, please?
Yeah, I'll take that. So, Justin, if you remember, we're a startup, mm-hmm. You know, albeit about 24 months in. But when we started this company 2 years ago, or I said, should say listed it 2 years ago, you know, we took in the conversations we're having with the market for our services and put some aspirational targets to them. You know, these included, you know, 3 to 6 advisory mandates and about approximately 4 acquisition and disposal mandates, establishing a life settlement backed bond. So, you know, these were aspirations that we set out and we were hoping to achieve. Now, I believe we have achieved some of these aspirations and certainly admit that we have been experiencing market conditions, but for the most part, they are on track, and if anything, they have changed in the way we approach them.
Yeah. So tell me, why did the aspirations change then?
Well, the aspirations are still basically the same, but the change has come in, you know, the way that the approach is to getting them accomplished. So the simple answer is that, you know, we adapt to institutional investor requirements and adjust to market conditions. Now, you know, for instance, the fees generated in a disposal and acquisition mandates dropped, and we determined that it was not really worth the time. So it was a cost-benefit analysis there. Our first advisory mandate merged into the fund. They liked the idea of the fund and waited for that and merged into that. And then, you know, effectively, the Black Oak Alpha Fund is an advisory mandate. And also, the short-term credit facility that we announced is a type of advisory mandate. And how these sort of come about over days and weeks and months of communications with our prospects, prospective clients, is that, as you know, we announced a proprietary hybrid product, which is essentially a debt equity structure. And we had a round table with the top 10 insurance companies in the UK, which was arranged by one of our partners, EY, and we had a great conversations with them. And as these conversations occurred, they liked what they saw, but some liked the debt aspect of it, others liked the equity aspect of it. So essentially, that hybrid is moved on to focusing on the individual pieces separately. So essentially, the fund is the equity part, and the bonds that we are developing through the short-term credit facility is the debt part. So this is a, you know, example of how the conversations have pivoted. And, you know, keep in mind that we're still having discussions on the advisory mandates for separate managed funds. And, you know, these are ongoing. And we're very optimistic that these will still occur.
Okay, Danny, you've worked with every level of investor in this asset class in previous roles. Of the investors and clients Alpha is interacting with, what are your thoughts in regards to the strategies you're working on?
Well, most of the groups that we've worked with in the past would be your typical structure. It would be a closed-end fund or an open-ended fund structure like we have with Black Oak. Most of the other strategies that we're working on, it's much more robust and complex. We're taking these life insurance policies and we're using them inside of these vehicles, for example, a bond offering. So doing those type of structures just seem to be a little more complicated, and it requires a lot more due diligence than most of the other structures that we've worked on in the past.
Okay, understood. How have the announced strategies, how are they progressing?
Yeah, I'll take that, Justin. Yeah, so let me start with the most recent. I mean, the short-term credit facility that we announced, we're all set for getting this in place Q1. But as you know, we are faced, towards the end of February, we're faced with an unprecedented event that has an impact on, you know, the workforce and a knock-on effect on the financial community. And so what the, you know, this COVID-19 situation has done, you know, is a little bit twofold. On one hand, you know, the volatility that it's created in the financial markets has drawn attention to our non-correlated asset class. But in terms of actually the logistics of people now working from home, excuse me, and, you know, the separation in communications and inability to meet, and those things have just slowed the process down considerably. And so the large financial group in the UK that we're working with was one of the first to send their workforce to work from home. And, you know, we had documentation that was already started that was well in progress and, you know, just need to complete it. And I'm hopeful once that we get our politicians let us sort of get back to work and be able to move things forward. And then what I would say is, you know, stand back. I think, you know, we're basically holding the reins here to something that is going to take off pretty well. And then, of course, the Black Oak Alpha Growth Fund, we got that launched. We had the initial allocations brought in. We had Q4 of last year to get all the operational pieces in place and our track record verified by KPMG, and got everything in place. And Jan 1, Austin, you know, hit the ground running, and indications are really great, and I'm going to let Austin speak to this here in a second. But, you know, a lot of people are rebalancing their portfolios, their equity portfolios, because of the markets were being very toppy, and they wanted to move into this. So we're respecting, you know, a number of great allocations Q1. But, you know, they've been now pushed back, not canceled, but pushed back. And but nevertheless, we continue to grow and take calls. And Austin, yeah, jump in.
Thanks, Gobin. Thanks for the brief intro there. We, as you know, we are marketing the fund in the U.S. pretty much from coast to coast. And, you know, in the launch phase, there's a lot of important steps that need to be taken and at the right time. So we're taking the you know, the fund's thesis and design and matching it up with interested investors, which primarily are the family office, institutional, high net worth, mass affluent space. And, you know, we created all the marketing materials. We have everything all ready to go and out there in the market. We're identifying anchor investors and, you know, establishing a presence on custodial platforms. So as you can appreciate, it's quite a process, but we've made really good progress. And, you know, as Gobin mentioned, we're expecting quite a few allocations early in the year. You know, however, with respect to this COVID-19 issue, we've kind of put the brakes on things, as it were. But a lot of investors really appreciate the non-correlated aspect of the asset, and the way we've structured it also gives the investors, or our investors, tax favorable tax treatment. So, you know, the space is growing rapidly. As Danny mentioned, you have people understanding they can trade their assets, which is the policy. And that just creates a larger, you know, market share. You know, and the U.S. has an incredible amount of life insurance. So I anticipate that this asset class will grow in the coming years. And, you know, as more people sell their policies, that would lead to potential for the investment side to expand as well. So, hopefully in end of April is when we're really, you know, apparently going to be able to have meetings and travel again. So, we're just kind of in that time period right now, Justin.
Mm-hmm. I understand. So what are the aspirational goals now through the next two quarters, given, you know, the current environment?
Right. I think everybody knows, what the situations are globally. We're certainly, get hourly, if daily, if not hourly updates. But look, from what we know now and how we see things working out from the conversations that we're having, as I mentioned before, we expect to produce revenues this calendar year. And how we expect to do this is pretty simple. We're going to concentrate on the work at hand. We have plenty to do. This includes getting the credit facility in place, doing marketing the fund and completing some of these discussions on separate managed accounts that we're having. So, and this, doesn't preclude all the unsolicited inquiries that we're still getting. And, we're trying to capitalize on everything that is coming our way, but at the same time keep our operations in a efficient, lean manner and build value for the shareholders, which include ourselves.
Excellent stuff. Okay, guys. Well, normally what I do at the end of an interview is ask for three quick reasons why someone should add you to their watch list. Because there's three of you, I suppose it's quite appropriate. We ask each one of you the prospects for the future, please.
Yeah, I'll go first. I'll speak for myself, and then obviously Danny and Austin will follow. But, I truly believe I would not have started this journey if I did not believe that longevity assets managed by a transparent and high visibility manager like ourselves will eventually lead the best of breed advisory in this asset class. And we are working hard to do this. And I also want to just say, I want to thank our dedicated shareholders. I hear from many, and the ones that give us good constructive feedback, we're taking and feeding and building upon that, as well as, this is a project that we're in it for the long term. This is, in our view, a marathon, not a sprint. Danny, do you want to take the next one?
Sure. As Gobin said, we're in a unique asset class, and we're experienced in this asset class, and we are planning on taking this to the next level.
Austin?
I've been involved in investment marketing for almost a decade, and this is, this asset class has characteristics kind of, it's in a class of its own, which I think... which interests investors maybe first on a curiosity level, but as they dig deeper, and I will say there is an education component, because as everyone on this call knows, it's the market is growing, still on the still has some growing to do, but people really especially right now when all the volatility is in the market, the asset class really shines. So we're looking forward to grow and outpace other investment classes. And as investors become more sophisticated, we've been watching this trend for the whole time I've been in investments, is that investors are becoming more sophisticated. They're moving off of brokerages and they're heading towards advisors, which in practical terms meaning they're going away from commissions and they're embracing the fee structure. And that's been a big theme over the last 5 years. Congress and all the rest of it have made attempted to regulate it because of the perceived conflict of interest, but for that reason and the greater availability of policies, we're expecting this space to dramatically out grow in the next coming years and decades. The last one I'll really touch on is that it's a great hedge on traditional markets. So there's a lot of ways to use it in the investor's portfolio, but the actual gains are very attractive as well, which usually fall in the mid-teens. So as far as the overall market and outlook, very exciting. And, you know, looking, it's exciting for me to get in kind of, you know, in the growing phase of it, because you have a real opportunity to make an outsized impact in the industry. So very, very excited for the rest of this year and the following years.
Excellent stuff. Guys, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justin. Pleasure to be with you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Keith Coughlan, Managing Director of European Metal Holdings, EMH ticker there. Keith, thanks for joining me.
No problem at all, Justin. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, well, I've heard a lot of people mention you on social media to me and say, have a look at this company. And so it's of interest to me. I don't know a lot about you. I know a little bit. So for people like me and others out there, Keith, could you, before we dig into some specific news, give us a brief summary as to what European Metal Holdings is about, please?
Certainly, Justin. So European Metal Holdings is developing the largest lithium resource in Europe. That's the Cinovex project in the Czech Republic on the border with Germany. It's a historic tin mine. They mined tin off and on there for nearly 600 years, an old underground mine. But it's got a very, very rich and large endowment of lithium. And we've been developing this asset to supply into the growing European EV and battery industries.
Yeah, and of course, we all know it's coming. I've said before, I've never heard anything like this, where every government pretty much has put a hard stop date on diesel and petrol engines. So we all know an EV revolution is going to happen. It's just a matter of time. At the moment, we're going through this, you know, COVID-19 issue, and that suppressed everything. But we know in the end there's going to be a huge demand, isn't there, for this kind of...
Well, there is. There's been no change in the level of commitment from the various governments and the EU themselves, and also from a number of very large companies operating in the region, you know, notably Volkswagen, which is the one that everyone looks to, you know, in Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, the commitment to an electric vehicle future is very strong, and the commitment to building a standalone battery industry within the EU is similarly very strong. And yeah, both of those things are good for us.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right in the heart there of Europe. So you've got your BMW, Mercedes, Volkswagen, some of the biggest, Porsche. Wow, some amazing producers there. So news-wise, Keith, you announced on Friday a final agreement of a significant investment. Can you take us through this, please?
Certainly. So a Czech company called CEZ, C-E-Z, mm-hmm, which is the power utility in the Czech Republic, 70% owned by the Czech government. It's a listed company with a market capitalization of about 12 or 13 billion. Has taken a 51% stake in our project, in Cinovex, directly into the project for just over 29 million euros. So that's a significant investment. It's very good to have CEZ involved simply because of who they are, how big they are, and the support that they can bring to us. But it's also very comforting at this stage, uncertain stage of global markets, to have the project fully funded now, right through to the decision to construct. So that money they're putting in, 29 odd million euros directly into the project, will see us through, as I say, to a decision to construct, all the way through our definitive feasibility studies, our bankability, and all the test work we have to do. So it's very good to have that certainty in the project now, as I say, particularly as the world is a little uncertain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is validation of the project. In fact, take us through some of the fundamentals of the project there, if you could, Keith.
Certainly. Well, we've conducted two preliminary feasibility studies on the project over the last few years. The most recent one is about 12 months ago now. That demonstrated an NPV of about $1.2 billion for the project, an IRR of almost 29%. And equally importantly, it showed that we were able to produce battery-grade lithium hydroxide or battery-grade lithium carbonate in the bottom half of the global cost curve. So not only is it a very big project right on the doorstep of the European car manufacturers, it also has very, very robust economics.
Yeah, absolutely. And give us a timeline then, Keith. So the next milestone, how long over the next couple of years or so?
Well, in the very short term, the deal we announced Friday is only subject now to shareholder approval from our shareholders at a general meeting that we will hold in the latter half of April, targeting around about the 20th. So that'll be the first milestone to see that approval come through. I have no reason to believe that approval won't be delivered. And then the full settlement of the transaction with the money going into the project. Excuse me. We will then kick on immediately with the detailed engineering of the definitive feasibility study. So the milestones that shareholders will see will be along the lines of the appointment of the detailed engineering, the layout of the various studies that we need to do, some further drilling that we need to do, not to find more lithium, but to bring a greater portion of the resource further up the confidence scale in the JORC tables, and then I believe we'll see discussions along the lines of strategic partnerships and offtakes. So they're the sorts of milestones shareholders can expect to see over the course of the next 6 or so months.
Yeah, absolutely. And then if everything goes well, I mean, how long before you get to sort of, build, I mean, there's obviously a lot of hurdles before that, but build a mine and get it up into production?
Well, we're targeting to be able to deliver into the expected dramatic ramp up of demand in Europe late 2024, early 2025. Mm-hmm. And that's really where the major automotives are saying that the numbers of EVs that they manufacture in Europe will grow significantly. Yeah. So we're on track with the program that we have to be ready to deliver into that. Importantly, the agreements to deliver into it will come well ahead of those dates, obviously. Offtake should be set at least in part over the course of the DFS, so over the course of the next 12 months. But we will stand ready to deliver battery-grade material into the European market when the car manufacturers and the battery manufacturers need it the most.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Keith. Well, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of the progress you're making there and the potential here, but are not yet following the story, could you give them 3 quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Fox and add you to their watch list, please?
Certainly. Well, I think it's, if you look at a macro down to the micro scenario, the fact is that electric vehicle industry is coming and it's going to grow faster in Europe than anywhere else in the world. The European battery industry will grow just as quickly in order to keep up with the demand generated by the EV industry. And we are ideally placed, the largest project in Europe, now arguably the most advanced with the involvement of CEZ. And I believe that we'll become the preeminent EU battery material supply story going forward.
Excellent stuff. Keith, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time, Justin. All the best.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. And I assume you're at home, John, are you?
Yes, we're working from home. Everything is as usual from our perspective, just in another location.
Well, do you know what? The thing is, it will become the norm after a month, at least. But I mean, it's probably more than that. But I mean, after a month of working from home, that will be the new norm, won't it, for people, for everyone,
It has become the new norm really very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, so we'll see how it changes, the industry. Because I fear for, these big companies like WeWork that hold these offices. I don't know if people go back to them after a while because they realize, hang on, it's a big overhead, big expense they don't really need for some people. I mean, other people, obviously, some companies do need to be together. But increasingly so, we can work remotely. Okay, let's look at the market. The markets, as we're talking now, are tanking a bit. We've had, I think, Donald Trump is seem to last like change tack a little bit from really brushing this off as it'll be a temporary thing, we'll be done, we'll be back to work by April, mid-April. He now said last night that the deaths in America could hit 100,000 people, and he said it's quite serious. His tone was very different. It's almost like it's kind of hit him, because America's figures have been awful. They're now, of course, above China on death rates, and they're just increasing. So, and the markets are down, and look at the metals, commodities, silver and gold are the only I can see that are up. So it's a bit worrying, isn't it? So what's your thoughts, John, on the commodity space here? I mean, this is not the bottom, I don't think, you know?
Well, it feels like we're bouncing along the bottom in terms of commodity pricing. There are pros and cons going on in the world. There's clearly a pullback in demand in the West for commodities right now, manufacturers being more cautious. But I noticed that US manufacturers are trying hard to maintain production of some sort, maybe not full production, but perhaps sort of 50-75% of normal production rates. The problem then is, well, where are they going to sell all the produce? It's quite possible that Western consumers will continue to buy things. Certainly, online shopping seems to be doing very well at the moment. Although consumers are seen as taking a more cautious attitude, probably to shall we say large ticket items like cars and things like that. Mm-hmm. The CRU group were talking this morning about a pullback in demand. I think it was 8% for this year in commodity demand. But then on the other side of things, we're seeing that quite a lot of mines around the world are having to close temporarily because of government-enforced lockdowns. So Namibia and Peru, for example, probably quite a lot to be expected on the copper side in Chile. Whereas actually some other countries, countries with more sophisticated healthcare systems are likely to try and keep certain industries open, particularly with mines, where mines can isolate themselves really very easily and where they have quite good healthcare facilities on their campuses. I mean, they don't necessarily have big healthcare facilities, but they've got a bit there.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? I tweeted out today saying I'm not bearish because I'm in cash. I'm in cash because I'm bearish. And I said, and I did a video over the weekend looking at previous corrections and the data coming out on this one. And in my mind, this is going to be worse than a financial crisis. And for one simple reason, just the how broad the impact is here. I mean, in the financial crisis, it was the banks that seized up. And of course, they started pulling loans. There's less, it wasn't any liquidity in the system. So central banks helped that by pumping in liquidity. And that freed it up a little bit. It took a while to do that. But we got something different here. When I talk about US auto production is down 93%, all in a GM, Ford. They're all shut down. Everything's shut down. Everything of any consequence is shut down, from tourism, travel. So, and actually, we just chatted earlier, look on the news, it's all about COVID-19 pretty much. There's no other stories. Now, go back to the financial crisis, it was the big headline story was probably about that, but it wasn't dominating, you know, and this is dominating because it's dominating everyone's lives. And I just think, if you look at the, do you know what, I don't know if you know the figures here, but last week, America, 3.28 million signed on jobless. Now, that was in 1 week. Now, the highest previous before that was in the financial crisis, 665,000 in a week. This was five times as big as that, and they reckon it's going to get worse this week and next week, and they reckon in this month alone we'll have more people jobless in America than for the entire 2 years of the financial crisis, which was 8.7 million. So I just think this, we're going to take another leg down, because we're 29% down. The footage is the financial crisis was 47% down. I think we've yet to get the real carnage of what's happening here. Every company, even the online, like I said, online shoppers, online retailers, they can't work anymore because JD Sports, Boohoo, all these stock market stars have had to shut down operations because they can't operate in their warehouses, apparently, you know, under the guidelines. So everything. It's ground to a halt. Not just the banks this time. Everything. And the ironic thing is, it'll fall back on the banks, because J.D. Weatherspoon just said today, along with Burger King and all other companies, they're not going to pay their rent. And so, obviously, the people that hold that debt, you know, the people who own those properties, have got to pay their debt. So it's going to be a big problem, isn't it? Even going back, it'll all go back to the banks. You know?
Yes. No. It certainly looks bigger than the global financial crisis. There was a credit crisis just over a week ago got solved really very fast by central bank liquidity being pumped in. So we are thankful for that because bond markets were collapsing or have collapsed. But I always thought bonds were overrated anyway. At the end of the day, what matters is companies and that are able to repay their debt and the earnings that they make there. So I think the equity market is the place to play things. In this situation, I do think we're going to get a V-shaped recovery. Yes, we probably bounce along the bottom for a little bit, as we're seeing at the moment. But we are seeing the tide turning. We are at that moment where you might see the river of liquidity, which has all been rushing out to the sea, starting to come back in, and you get choppy waters in that sort of environment. So anyone who's ever been rowing on the river at this moment in time when the tide turns, it's very interesting, and it's very analogous to financial markets where we are now.
Yeah. And any company news? I mean, most of the news output of late, again, is like watching the news on TV. I mean, all companies are asking about, of course, is COVID-19, because it's impacting everyone, isn't it? So any thoughts, John?
Well, unfortunately, the accountancy profession is insisting that all companies produce a COVID-19 risk report before they sign off their accounts, which is like kicking a man when he's down, asking all these poor accountants who are suddenly having to work from home to produce these extra reports in a very difficult and stressful circumstances, and that's going to be impossible for some companies, particularly if your finance department have got the virus and aren't feeling too good or worse. But what we are seeing across the board is dividends being deferred from large companies to small companies. That's prudent to keep the cash within the group right now. We're seeing some companies suffering great distress. Some of the diamond companies are not able to sell their diamonds at the moment, which means that they can't get the revenue in. There will be trade finance to cover these things. So hope is not lost, and there's certainly lots of government liquidity to cover those sorts of events in certain countries. Now, certain emerging markets are not necessarily going to give the kind of support that we would expect, that we would hope to see in the UK and the US. So it's difficult to know how it's going to play out, but some companies are going to get hurt by that and literally just have to shut down and suspend their operations.
Yeah. And any specific news out? Is there anyone selling any diamonds? Diamonds, are there a bright spot somewhere?
Well, yes, actually, we saw Gem Diamonds report a sale of $12 million worth of stones. So that's good for them. So in fact, I would say that was just in the nick of time.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll be able to continue to sell their stones. Maybe not. It's difficult to know that the precise circumstances, but diamond buyers are not able to fly into South Africa, for example, to buy diamonds. So they have to sell those stones locally if there is demand for them. And I'm not convinced that the demand is going to be there for very long. So we have to hope that the coronavirus is over before their next sale. But it's great timing to have made this to report a sale right now, because perhaps things will be recovering then. And as we saw at the end of the global financial crisis, people did come out and start buying diamonds again for their loved ones. They started to realize that these things were important to them. So assuming that a lot of people won't have buried their other halves in the back garden by the end of this, then maybe more diamonds will actually be sold.
Yeah, well, in fact, I did laugh, but that's happened. But it hasn't happened. But it's happening right now, sadly. All this cabin fever stuff. Do you know what? Why isn't there any price for diamonds on any... I look around on markets. Why didn't you ever see a price? You get commodities, obviously. Why not diamonds?
Well, every diamond is individual, there's a lot of different price
carats, points. I suppose, no, you can't do it, can you?
There are diamond indices.
Oh, okay.
and there had been softening last year. Yeah. But companies, for example, BlueRock had actually managed to hold up its the prices received for its diamonds. Mm. Now, it may have been that the quality of the diamonds recovered were improving, but the index had shown a gradual decline last year, really because of the Trump's trade war and slightly less GDP growth going on. But in all, the market hadn't done so badly. But we certainly expect a suspension of buying because people can't go to jewelry stores to buy diamonds right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. Any other news there? You mentioned Vast, actually. Vast are involved.
Vast, very, very interesting company. Clearly, they've had issues in Romania, which haven't gone away in a hurry. But they're looking to develop or redevelop licenses in the Marange diamond fields. And Marange has been known as the most spectacular diamond find in many years, and many diamonds littering the ground in the Marange area. And in fact, so much so that the Chinese military moved in and even denied access to certain parts of that area to the Zimbabwean army, which was an interesting situation. But Vast have support from the local community there. They are looking to do a certain amount of exploration. They've had to postpone things for a little while due to the 21-day lockdown in Zimbabwe. But that won't cost Vast anything. So it's good that they'll be getting back in there and doing some work on the ground. And that could mean a good future for Vast.
Yeah, cool. Any other company news out?
Well, Scott Gold reported their interims. Not much going on there in that they're spending money on developing the Cannonish mine in Scotland. That's all the money is covered for that, all the capital costs. I think they're going to start gold production in May or June. So that's something good to look forward to. The gold price is reasonably encouraging at the moment. Well, it's more than encouraging. Gold at 1,591 this morning is a great price. And we know that Scottish gold sells for a significant premium. So very pleased to see Scott Gold, at least continuing and no trouble there, in my view.
Yeah, and let's be honest, I don't think gold hasn't finished its run yet, I don't think. We saw it's had an initial burst up. And like if you go back to the 2008 financial crash, gold moved down initially with stocks when everyone sold off, dashed for cash initially, and then all of a sudden, as the stocks continued south, gold started moving north. And so I think gold still has plenty to go in this, because let's be honest, all the governments can do is pump money in, isn't it? And increase the money supply, pretty much. So gold is going to be a bit of a safe haven, surely.
Absolutely. Gold is the place to be right now. Look, other things are going on in the world. China has extended the subsidies on electric vehicles, which is good news. And there's a whole bunch of other Chinese stimulus that's coming in. They've actually managed to get much of their industry up and running really very quickly. And I think now they need to just add a little bit of extra financial support to small and medium scale enterprises, and to really start to drive domestic demand for their products, because Western demand is going to dip as the coronavirus sweeps around the world. And they're going to need with these factories all back up and running, they're going to need to sell those products in somewhere. And we also noticed that inventory levels in Shanghai have fallen markedly in the last week. So that tells us that China is back at work and is restocking on metals inventories so that they can produce the goods that they love to produce.
Yeah, absolutely marvellous stuff. Right, cool. John, thanks for that, fella. And we'll speak to you next week. You know, I guarantee we'll all still be in our houses here, because let's be honest, this ain't going away too soon, is it?
Look, no, it's not. It's not going away in a hurry, and we're still some way off the peak in the US. But to put things into perspective, according to worldometers.info, the fatalities this year to date: 42,000 from the coronavirus, 121,000 from seasonal flu, 245,000 from malaria, etc. So
but you know what? Someone pointed out that the thing is, our system, we know how much people, you know, you can vaccinate against flu, and we know how many people will go through the system with flu. We struggle with flu. This is on top of flu, and we haven't got a vaccine, you know, which is, and that's on top of malaria as well. So any other problems we have, I mean, already the flu season is a bit of a hard work for our NHS. So this on top. Now, if you look at, you know, the UK, how many cases we've had like active cases at the moment, 23,000 active cases. It just shows you how much pressure that's going to put on the NHS, you know, when the, even that biggest hospital, in that temporary one we've set up, the NHS Nightingale, is 4,000 beds. Well, already it's 23,000 active cases in the UK. So you can see the pressure this puts on the UK, you know, on top of everything else, you know. It just it's amazing ingenuity, you know, of that NHS Nightingale. But it's just worrying, isn't it, the creak and our NHS staff not having the equipment and not being tested just compounds the problem, you know.
The testing is a major issue, and that's something governments have been slower than expected on. But I think the scale of the and the rapid spread of the virus has caught everyone by surprise.
Absolutely.
And I think some of the problem is that the tests haven't been working that reliably either. So
yeah.
I think sometimes people have been testing as negative when actually they've been positive. That really is a problem, because then people run around as if you know, feeling that they don't have any risk of infection, whereas they are. So There are known unknowns and unknown unknowns still out there.
Yeah, it's an awful situation. Hopefully we'll see a peak in the next few weeks, and we can start sort of winding down a bit. But they're making social distancing could be enforced for a while after even released, which is this is why the snapback to the economy won't happen, because people will still be a bit worried, you know, about going out. Anyway, John, speak to you next week. Thanks, fella.
Look forward to it. Bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Pathfinder Minerals, PFP, up 80% to 0.675 pence. At four, Equals Group, EQLS, down 6.67%, 21 pence. At three, All Active Asset Capital, that's a 0.775. up 10.7%. At two, Synergin, down 0.8% of 60.5 pence, or half pence. And number one is AA PLC. Don't know why they're following that on Twitter at the moment. And that's up 4% to 17.7 pence. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, it is Seven Digital Group. Seven Digital and Grandpad announce partnership renewal. At four, Fast Forward Innovations, Investee Company update, Leap Gaming. At three, DFS confirms Mahangi as a long, low-life, low-cost graphite project with $358 million NPV and an IRR of 91%. That's Armadale Capital, I assume. They never have their company name on the title of their RNS. Slightly annoying. At two, Fast Forward Innovations, Investee Company update, EMAC Life Sciences. And number one, Enkondesi, formal power tariff submitted there. They're down 10% at the moment, 4.05 pence. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.